Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who exactly is Wise made for? It's made for Austrians in Australia, South Africans in Sweden. It's made for New Delhi, New York, and even regular York. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
More than 2,000 top leaders from across China are gathered in Beijing, setting the country's agenda for the next 5 years. It's all about the vision of one man, Xi Jinping.
The other political practitioners at the center of the system are frankly politically frightened.
Also, Russia has a new general leading the war in Ukraine, a commander known for his win-at-all-cost ways in Syria.
He became known as a very reckless and brutal commander because he launched a series of attacks against civilian infrastructure in Syria.
I'm Marco Werman, and in Brazil, presidential candidates and public education. Many progressive Brazilians are marching for Lula. They say only he can preserve the country's public education system as Bolsonaro dials it back. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us this week. Today, people in Ukraine's capital woke up to a terrifying sound, waves of kamikaze drones striking Kyiv. Bursts of gunfire could be heard across the city as soldiers tried to shoot down the unmanned aerial vehicles. The sound here was captured by a police body cam right before a drone hits its target. Energy facilities and a residential building were damaged. Ukrainian authorities say four people were killed in the strikes, including a pregnant woman. In previous assaults on Kyiv, missiles were used, but Russia may now be trying to keep its stockpile intact. Each missile costs about $1 million. A drone with an explosive charge costs just $20,000. Today's barrage included attacks from 28 drones, with the Kremlin reportedly ordering more than 2,000 of the weapons from Iran. Iranian officials have denied this.
Я сьогодні вперше в історії українського Іранських відносин.
Speaking from a bomb shelter today, Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba called for European Union sanctions on Iran for providing the drones to Russia. Western nations have pledged to send systems to Ukraine that can shoot down drones, but much of that weaponry could be months away from arriving in country. It is fair to say that the Kremlin never planned for the war in Ukraine to last this long. Over the past 7 months, many of Russia's stated goals simply have not been reached. That's resulted in a lot of turnover among Russia's top military commanders. Now Moscow has appointed a seasoned general to lead its war effort in Ukraine. The World's Daniel Hoffman has his story.
The word that's most often used to describe General Sergei Surovikin is ruthless. His nickname is General Armageddon. Some say that's because of his hot temper. Others say the nickname reflects his approach to war.
Воєнні експерти відмічають, іменно серйозний бойовий опит поможе Суровикіну грамотно спланувати ход.
On Russian state media, Suravikin is praised for his years of military experience. He's described as all business, someone who gets the job done. Edina Boragan is an expert on Russia's security services. She says Suravikin already has a well-established record.
He's a professional army officer. He is 56 years old, and he started his military career during the Soviet times.
During the war in Afghanistan, Suravikin served in a special forces unit. Later, during the final days of the Soviet Union, Suravikin was in the thick of things as Kremlin hardliners tried to oust Mikhail Gorbachev.
With tanks in Red Square, the official word from the new government, calling itself the National Emergency Committee, was that the architect of Glasnost and Perestroika was too ill to continue in office.
When protesters took to the streets, Irina Boragan says Suravikin responded.
Suravikin was a young officer and he commanded a rifle division, and he ordered his soldiers to open fire on the protesters, and as a result, three men were killed.
The officer spent a few months in prison, but that didn't stop his rise up the ranks of Russia's military. Surovikin later served in Chechnya. He led Russian forces in Syria and became commander of Russia's air force.
He became known as a very reckless and brutal commander because he launched a series of attacks against civilian infrastructure in Syria, and he became notorious for indiscriminate bombardment of civilians in this country.
In 2020, Human Rights Watch listed Surovikin as a possible war criminal. During that time, Gleb Irisov was an officer in the Russian Air Force. He says he met Surovikin on multiple occasions and that the general was not well-liked.
The majority of Russian Air Force officers used to be very disappointed with his personality.
Irisov says Surovikin would lash out at subordinates and even resort to violence. But he says General Surovikin is the kind of officer that the Kremlin can rely on.
He seems to be very loyal directly to the highest Russian political power, directly to president, to government, not to his chain of command, but directly to this political power.
Звание Героя Российской Федерации присвоено. Генерал-полковнику Суровикину Сергею Владимировичу.
In 2017, Sergei Surovikin was awarded the Hero of the Russian Federation Medal, Russia's highest honor. At a ceremony in Moscow, the general expressed his loyalty to President Putin, saying, "We're ready to execute your orders." Robert Hamilton is a retired U.S. Army colonel. He's now a research professor at the United States Army War College. Hamilton was based in the Middle East and kept up communications with Russian military operating in Syria, including General Surovikin.
We had daily interaction with the Russian headquarters in Syria, and I sat in on all the calls with General Surovikin. So got a little sense for him as a commander.
So what will Surovikin bring to the job as commander of Russian forces in Ukraine? Since his appointment, Russia has launched scores of long-range missiles into city centers.
Surovikin is certainly comfortable carrying out those types of attacks because he oversaw those types of attacks in Syria. I don't think there'll be any institutional or personal break or restraint if the Kremlin orders the targeting of civilians in Ukraine.
That means more civilian casualties in the future. But Hamilton says turning things around for the Russian military on the battlefield is another matter altogether.
Having Surovikin in theater in charge may not be as big an advantage as it would normally be because he may not have the authority to make the types of decisions that a normal theater commander would have to make. Because I think probably he has to seek approval from the Kremlin to do things that in Western militaries, a theater commander would just have the authority to do on his or her own.
Some experts say that Vladimir Putin appears to be micromanaging Russia's war in Ukraine. As for General Sergei Surovikin, his record shows that he's not one to protest. He'll keep following orders. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
In Beijing's Great Hall of the People, the twice-in-a-decade Communist Party Congress is underway. Leader Xi Jinping's opening speech on Sunday ran nearly 2 hours. It was a reminder that Xi is a key player with a bully pulpit, challenging the world order of the past century. To learn more about Xi's mindset, we reached out to Kevin Rudd. Rudd is a former prime minister of Australia and also fluent in Mandarin. He spent a lot of time with Xi and has gotten to know him personally. Rudd says he heard key takeaways in the Chinese leader's speech, also known as a work report.
The first is that we see the return of ideological man. That is the reassertion of Marxism-Leninism as a guiding ideological and therefore policy framework for what China does both on domestic policy and international policy. The second is on the economy itself, where one of the reasons the Chinese economy has slowed in recent years is that he's begun to move the dial on Chinese economic policy more to the Marxist left. This Congress report continues that trend. It doesn't bring it back towards the market. And so therefore, you're going to see a more isolating China in the future, and one which as a result, in my judgment, will suffer from slowing economic growth. And in years gone by, the reports to the Congress over the last 20 to 30 years would basically say, look, it's okay out there in the world, no major wars on the horizon, it should be fine. However, what we see with this one is the dropping of that language. And as a result, you therefore basically signaling to the system that it's become a much more hostile strategic environment. And they begin, therefore, to make preparations for the possibility, longer term, of armed conflict.
Yeah, so specifically, what does all this mean for China's actual ambitions on the world stage?
What you're going to see, therefore, is firstly, a more assertive Chinese foreign policy. Secondly, you're going to see more military preparations being made to anticipate possible armed conflict with the United States over Taiwan or elsewhere. But thirdly, you'll see China adopting a more protectionist approach to its economy as it seeks to protect what it describes as its own strategic supply chains with the rest of the world so that they're not interrupted by sanctions or other forms of interruption over them becoming engaged in an armed conflict with the U.S. over Taiwan.
What will not be said at this Congress that you think is crucial to understanding really what direction China is taking under Xi?
What has not been said at this Congress is what is Xi Jinping's actual timetable over Taiwan. Obviously, they're not going to signal any such thing, which has a high degree of military sensitivity attached to it. What I can see from the text is a predisposition on Xi's part to tell the system to get themselves prepared. I think, however, what you see in the near term is a predisposition to ensure that they try and calm things with the Taiwanese and with the Americans over the Taiwan Straits, while the leadership in Beijing sets out to complete its preparations militarily, financially, and economically for what I judge to be a likely timetable sometime in the 2030s.
Is there anyone with any influence, someone close to Xi possibly, who is pushing back on his worldview and telling him his agenda may be self-defeating? I mean, there are looming economic concerns on the domestic front that warrant perhaps greater attention, right?
There are many critiques in terms of Xi Jinping's current performance from within the system, so-called dynamic zero COVID and the lockdown of all these cities right across China with huge social and economic consequences. In addition to that, the movement to the left on the economy we spoke about before, which is alienating large slices of China's entrepreneurial community, plus long-standing foreign policy and international economic policy professionals who are highly dubious about the wisdom of moving militarily anytime soon on the Taiwan question. However, we see no evidence so far that there is a single figure or group of leaders capable of bringing these threads of policy and political opposition to Xi Jinping and forming a basis to either change his course or, for that matter, remove him as leader. We will monitor this over the years to come leading up to the next party Congress. But at this stage, it's opposition in theory rather than direct political practice, because the other political practitioners at the center of the system are frankly politically frightened.
So up until recently, Xi seemed to be almost single-mindedly focused on one goal, building up China's economy. We knew that flexing muscles abroad was on the agenda, it just didn't seem to be at the top of the agenda. Has Xi now flipped those priorities?
You're right to say that the development of the economy has been China's central objective, really since Deng Xiaoping assumed the leadership back in 1982. And in one form or another, it was clear right through until the last party Congress in 2017, which did occur under Xi's leadership himself. So for that intervening 35-year period, it is a case of economic growth being number one, and everything else coming in at 4, 5, and 6 after it. However, after 2017, Xi Jinping began to change the emphasis in two respects. He began to say, well, economic growth is all well and good, but there are a whole bunch of imbalances and inequalities which now need to be attended to within the Chinese system in order to make this politically sustainable. And then with this Congress report, you do see language emerging which suggests that the national security agenda is now, in fact, at least of co-equal importance with the economic agenda, or perhaps more important than the economic agenda.
Kevin Rudd, a former Prime Minister of Australia, he now heads the Asia Society and is author of The Avoidable War, The Dangers of a Catastrophic Conflict Between the U.S. and Xi Jinping's China. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Good to be with you on the program.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Brazil, two presidential candidates with two very different visions for public education. Incumbent Jair Bolsonaro has steadily been making cuts to the system. His challenger, former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, says he would expand it. As Michael Fox reports from the Brazilian city of Recife, voters in northeastern Brazil, where poverty is high, feel that their very livelihoods depend on Lula's victory.
Tens of thousands are in the streets of Recife. It's a sea of red, the color of Lula's Workers' Party. Lula is in town for a campaign rally, and his supporters are ecstatic. They chant and sing. The march extends for blocks, winding across town. This is Lula country, the state he was born in, Pernambuco, and they voted overwhelmingly for him here in the first round. That includes Priscila Marinho. She's young, tall, and black, wearing sunglasses and curly shoulder-length hair.
Eu sou cria de universidade pública, né? Me formei na graduação na Universidade Federal Rural de Pernambuco.
I am the daughter of the public university, she says. I also did a master's, and I had this opportunity because of the Lula government. Without a doubt, she says, black youth are here marching to guarantee that the next generation have their rights to education preserved. Lula's legacy for Brazil's education system runs deep. When he ran the country from 2003 to 2010, he created nearly 200 private and federal university systems and campuses. The number of students nearly doubled, and access for people of color expanded dramatically. By 2011, 70% of public universities had affirmative action programs. Professor Gisele Costa says Lula's policies were a huge success, particularly in northeastern Brazil.
Mas isso para a pessoa que não tinha acesso à universidade se configura como muito importante.
For those who had never had access to university education before, it was really important, she says. If you have a master's or a doctorate, that's like a title of nobility for a population that's 29% functionally illiterate, she says. By contrast, President Bolsonaro has long fought with the country's university system. His first year in office, he rolled out major funding cuts, and they have continued throughout his presidency. Last year, his then-Minister of Education, Milton Ribeiro, said higher education should be scaled back.
Universidade, na verdade, ela deveria ser para poucos, nesse sentido.
Universities should be for the few, not for everyone, he said. We have too many engineers and lawyers driving Uber because they can't get a job in their area. Bolsonaro has also criticized Brazil's education system for having a liberal bias. He tried to rein that in by replacing some federal university directors and transforming more than 100 high schools into civic military academies. Right now, he's backing a bill in the Senate that would authorize homeschooling, a move welcomed by his evangelical Christian base.
Por isso que eu acho que tinha que voltar à educação moral e cívica nas escolas, OSTV.
Bolsonaro supporters have also called for the return of the civic moral education classes that were mandatory under Brazil's military dictatorship, as a guest argues on this conservative podcast. But the people on the streets of Recife say that's not the direction they want for their country.
Nós vimos isso acontecer. Nós vimos acontecer.
We've seen what Lula can do, how the lives of the people improve, says university professor Valeria Silva. Today, going with Lula again means picking up his development project so that people have education and health and can get out of this situation of hunger and poverty, she says. Hunger and poverty have indeed been rising in northeast Brazil, which is one reason people here voted nearly 2.5 times more for Lula than Bolsonaro in the first round of the election. They hope they can lift him to victory again in the second round on October 30th. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Recife, Pernambuco.
Many European countries are dealing with an energy crisis due to the war in Ukraine. Poland provides one example. Until this past spring, Poland was among the top 3 importers of Russian oil. No longer. And most Poles say there's no going back. As reporter Rebecca Rossman reports from Warsaw, Poland is having a tough time navigating its new life without Russian energy.
Yeah, there's the boiler, heart of our heating system. It works for gas.
Valdemar Carroll shows me around his spacious apartment where he lives with his partner and two young daughters. Carroll is a genealogist and translator in Przemyśl, a small town on the Polish-Ukrainian border. Are you worried about this winter?
A little bit, yes. Everybody is worrying, I believe. We still do not feel it. We haven't been affected till now, but winter is coming.
He points to a fireplace in his living room.
And here we've got some kind of backup. So in case of lack of gas, we will use woods.
For years, Poland has been vowing to wean itself from Russian energy imports. But that was a big challenge.
In the past, we had like 80% or over 80% of gas coming from Russia, and also 80% of oil coming from Russia. So now things are rapidly changing.
That's Joanna Pandera, who heads the Warsaw-based think tank Forum Energy. She applauds the Polish government for its commitment to cutting off Russian energy imports. Now, she says, Poland imports zero gas from Russia. In addition to gas and oil, Poland has also historically relied on Russia for coal. It's no longer importing Russian coal, and that's a problem.
Polish households are struggling where to get coal from and how to heat our homes. So it became really very sensitive issue and very political issue where everybody discussed it may be that we'll be freezing in winter.
Because of the embargo against Russian imports, around 60% of Polish households say they don't have enough coal to get through the winter. Poland is now importing natural gas from other countries, including the U.S. and Norway via the Baltic Pipe, which opened earlier this month. But energy prices are soaring. Some universities say they're being forced to move classes online after energy bills shot up by as much as 700%. The situation led to a standoff between Poland's central government and a number of opposition mayors from cities across the country. They protested in central Warsaw earlier this month, demanding that the government step in to cap energy prices. Jacek Karnowski is the mayor of Sopot, a town of around 40,000 people on the Baltic coast.
We are against the big prices of the electricity. It's increased 1,000%. It's impossible to pay for it for our cities, for our communes, for our citizens, for our private companies.
In the end, the mayors got their way. Last week, the Polish government said it would impose energy price caps through the end of 2023. That means most consumers will see their monthly energy bills increase, but only by about 8 to 15%. Energy shortages will continue to be an issue, says Joanna Pandera with Forum Energy.
You may expect that for 3 hours in some region there will be no electricity, and you just need to prepare it for it.
But she's convinced that stopping the money flow to Russia was the right decision, and that Poles are ready to deal with the consequences, which she says will be temporary.
I'm 100% convinced that next winter will be easier, and, year by year it will be easier.
Pandera says Poland is in the middle of a difficult divorce, and while that's painful, most Poles are determined to move on. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Warsaw.
You're listening to The World. In Chile, it happens once or twice a decade, a blooming carpet of flowers in one of the driest places on Earth. If a plant can resist long periods of drought, the scientist says the genetic information is invaluable. But climate change now threatens the unique ecosystem of the Atacama Desert. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Viktor Orban, Hungary's prime minister, rarely misses an opportunity to slam one specific person, Hungarian-born philanthropist George Soros. Orban says Soros and other shareholders of big energy companies are raking in billions while the war in Ukraine drags on. Soros is Jewish and lives in the U.S. Orban's frequent demonization of Soros makes some in Hungary's Jewish community deeply uncomfortable. From Budapest, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Everyday tour guide Erica Sood
talks to tourists from around the world about the Jewish community in Hungary.
Just two corners from here on the left side, Kozinski Street has an Orthodox synagogue. Just one corner from here in Kosher Deli. If you are interested in kosher food, then I can recommend that place.
Sooth works with the Dohán Synagogue in Budapest. It's the largest synagogue in Europe and the second biggest in the world, outside of Jerusalem. And in the courtyard, there's a cemetery.
And from the end of the World War II, here we have the cemetery with the mass graves, altogether 24 mass graves with 2,281 persons.
More than 500,000 Hungarian Jews were killed during the Holocaust. Before the Second World War, around 800,000 Jews lived in Hungary. Today, the population is less than 100,000. Hungary's chief rabbi, Robert Frohlich, lives in a street right next to the synagogue. Two security guards meet me at the door and search my bag.
Just bag, okay?
Yeah.
Just bag?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Lovely to meet you.
Pleasure's mine.
Frohlich is dressed casually in a blue T-shirt and black trousers. Only the yarmulke on his head gives away that he's Jewish. The chief rabbi tells me there are very few violent anti-Semitic attacks in Hungary today. Most of the abuse is verbal, he says. But with the economy struggling, he says, Jews once again are encountering racist stereotypes that go back generations.
And now the situation is very, very hard here in Hungary. And of course, it's because of the Jews. Yeah, sure. Because of the war, of course, and because of Brussels. But as we know that Ukraine is full of Jews and Brussels is full of Jews, so it's all because of the Jews.
Who says this?
The far right.
One thing that doesn't help, some Jewish leaders say, is Viktor Orban's constant demonization of George Soros.
Don't be afraid to call your enemies by their name. Consider, for example, George Soros. He believes in none of the things
That's Orban speaking this summer at a conservative political conference in Texas. The prime minister often accuses Soros of encouraging migrants to come to Europe. In the lead up to the 2018 elections in Hungary, anti-immigration posters appeared on billboards across the country, featuring a laughing George Soros. Underneath was the slogan, "Don't let Soros have the last laugh." The campaign was government funded. Rabbi Frohlich says he found it deeply offensive.
The portrait of a laughing Jew, it was very clear and very simple to decode. They didn't say that the Jew is George Soros. No. But everything showed that he's an evil Jew.
In July this year, Orban sparked international outrage with this speech in Romania.
Ezért harcoltunk mindig, egymással hajlandóak vagyunk keveredni.
We are willing to mix with one another, Orban said about his fellow Hungarians, but we do not want to become peoples of mixed race. A long-term advisor of Orban's, who's Jewish, quit, saying the speech was straight out of the Nazi era. When I ask Rabbi Frohlich about the speech, he says he doesn't want to speak about it publicly. The Federation of Hungarian Jewish Communities did write to the Prime Minister after that speech. András Heisler is the group's president.
I've wrote that this is worrying and unfortunate for the members of the Jewish community. That's why I asked him for a meeting.
And have you met with him? Has he responded?
Not yet.
Do you think he will?
I don't know. I am waiting.
But Heisler is reluctant to say anything too critical about the Prime Minister. Theatre director András Borgala, who describes himself as a cultural or non-religious Jew, says there's a reason the leaders of Hungary's Jewish community are so reticent to speak out.
Those rabbis are strongly supported and their community is strongly supported by the government. Most of the money, if not 100% of their budget, would come from the government.
Borgala runs Golem Theatre, Hungary's only Jewish theatre. He's an outspoken critic of Viktor Orban and says his theatre gets little state support. At the moment, he's staging a play called Bad Jews by an American writer. Borgala says all of his productions contain themes that affect the Jewish community, But not all his actors are Jewish.
That's why we do something before every production, which we call the Jewinator. I collect everybody, and they became Jews for a week. We go to see a rabbi, we go to eat kosher food, even learning Talmud. So we turn the actors and the artists Jews for that week.
Anne Borgele says he opened his theatre in this particular part of Budapest for a reason.
We are sitting in the middle, was the ghetto once. And when the ghetto was liberated, more than 2,000 bodies were in the square. Just like really, again, you can see it from here if you look out the window. And this is part of why we asked the local municipality to give us a space here.
Borgele says he wants to remember Hungary's Jewish history, but also to show that Jewish life can thrive once again in this country, even under the rule of Viktor Orban. For the world, I'm Orla Barry, Budapest, Hungary.
Across Nigeria, major flooding for the past several weeks has left more than 600 people dead. That's according to Nigeria's Minister of Humanitarian Affairs. It's also estimated that close to 1.5 million people have been displaced and some 200,000 homes destroyed. It is the worst flooding in Nigeria in a decade. It has many people there asking, why was the country not better prepared? Joining us now from Lagos, Nigeria, is Nosmot Badamosi. She's a contributor and a writer with Foreign Policy Magazine's Africa Brief. Nosmot, what have you seen so far in terms of the flooding and who and what has been impacted?
The flooding has impacted 33 out of Nigeria's 36 states. So that is pretty much the majority of the country. In terms of some of the southern states, it's affected roads. There are cars that are fully immersed in the water. But the most significant issue is that it has affected the country's breadbasket. That is a critical problem for food security in the country.
What kind of warnings were there for the regions that have been affected by these floods? Anything?
There was, unfortunately. So Nigeria's hydrological agency issued alerts 6 months ago, but there was a lack of adequate preparation by authorities with those early warning systems. Some states in Nigeria flood every rainy season, so this is not new. But unfortunately, the Nigerian government has failed to adequately deal with putting in place proper drainage systems. Many houses and unofficial settlements in Nigeria are built in floodplains. Also kind of exacerbating the problem was the release of excess water from a dam in neighboring Cameroon, which made the issue much worse.
Right. So heavy rain swelling the banks of the Niger River, heavy rains falling on fields. Talk more about that dam that Cameroon opened up. Did Cameroonian officials consult with Nigerian leaders about what opening that dam would do to people in Nigeria?
Cameroonian authorities say this was a planned release. It was in consultation with Nigerian authorities. That is disputed. The main issue was Nigeria was meant to sort of build another dam to kind of take in that excess water. And unfortunately, that wasn't done.
So an especially heavy rainy season this year and failing better drainage schemes, what has the government response been so far? I mean, how are they trying to help the people whose homes were destroyed or who are now spread across the country?
So Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, he announced there has been 12,000 metric tons of food items from federal reserves that is going out to communities, and authorities are providing other sort of humanitarian support, but that response has been slow. The floods have been sort of progressively getting worse since August, so the response has been just a little bit too slow.
Yeah, well, you said 33 out of Nigeria's 36 federal states have been affected, nearly 1.5 million people impacted. When we talk humanitarian support, what are the most urgent needs right now?
Well, there are concerns about the spread of disease. Also, as we mentioned earlier, food supplies, those have been slow to reach those in need. The United Nations Humanitarian Agency warned earlier that a cholera outbreak is currently spreading among communities. already displaced by insurgencies in the northern region and now impacted by floods.
Nosma, when do you expect the water levels to recede across the country? Have officials said anything about that yet?
They have, but unfortunately, it's not for a while. So Nigeria's Meteorological Agency has warned that the flooding could continue until the end of November in some southern states, so such as Anambra, Delta, the Cross River states. All of those areas are forecasted to still be affected by heavy flooding.
And apparently Nigeria's oil sector has also been impacted by this, right? How has that occurred?
The Delta state that I mentioned, that is where a lot of the oil pipelines are. And that's the region that's also heavily affected by flooding. There is a fuel shortage as well that, you know, is being caused by crisis in Ukraine. And all of this is just coming together.
Nosmat Badamosi is a journalist and a writer with Foreign Policy Magazine's Africa Brief. She joined us from Lagos, speaking about the weeks of flooding across the country there. Nosmat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In northern Chile, an extraordinary natural spectacle is unfolding. Parts of the Atacama Desert are covered in a blooming carpet of flowers. It's an incredible sight that does not happen very often and attracts tourists and botanists from across the globe. But as the world's TBS Isaya reports, the future of this event is now in question.
It almost never rains here in the Atacama Desert. This area is so dry that it's used as a practice site for expeditions to Mars. But once or twice every decade, the skies open up and it rains, causing dormant seeds underground to grow. The result is a spectacular flowering desert that lasts only for a few weeks. I'm here in the middle of this desert where I see a huge esplanade of sand covered by pink flowers on one side, white flowers on the other side. There are yellow, orange, and violet flowers spread across the sand, but also insects and birds that come to the desert only during this moment. It's a surreal sight. It's like the desert stops being the desert for a little while. Carlos Silva and Ana Maria Acuña drove 23 hours from across the country to see the flowering desert. Silva says this trip is a gift for his wife's birthday. It's a unique and wonderful phenomenon, he says. We wanted to come now because we don't know when it will happen again. The flowering desert only happens every 5 to 7 years, and it's difficult to predict, says Montserrat Barrientos. She's a tour guide for the blooming desert.
Es un juego entre temperatura y agua caída.
She tells me that there needs to be a perfect combination of precipitation and temperature for the flowers to bloom.
El desierto florido se han nombrado y datado más.
Barrientos says there are more than 200 species of plants flowering right now. She asks everyone to be careful when they step so they don't smash the flowers. The most emblematic one is a little pink flower that carpets large swaths of the desert. It's called pata de guanaco or guanaco feet. Guanaco is a wild llama from this area whose feet look similar to the leaves of the flower.
Por ejemplo, la hoja de la pata de guanaco es muy gorda.
She is showing me the leaves of this flower, this pink flower. They're actually almost attached to the floor, like the flower has feet, like the leaves are the feet, and they're very thick to store water. For many scientists, the flowering desert is an exciting event. It proves the resilience of certain types of flora in the world's driest desert. Benito Gomez Silva is a microbiologist at the University of Antofagasta. I visited his lab where he's studying microorganisms that are very resistant to extreme water scarcity in this desert.
Si una planta es capaz de resistir largos periodos de desecación,
If a plant can resist long periods of drought, he says, its genetic material has useful information for people who work on genetically modified plants. But the flowering desert is at risk. Climate change is one threat, says Cesar Pizarro. He's a biologist with the Chilean Department of Conservation.
Podríamos tener también mayor periodo de sequía.
Longer drought, he says, or heavier rains could affect the frequency of the desert bloom, and eventually it could even stop happening. Another threat are traffickers who collect native plants or visitors who pluck flowers to bring home. This is why Chile's President Gabriel Boric announced recently that the desert will be designated as a national park.
Personas inescrupulosas le hacen daño al desierto porque piensan que detrás del desierto, debajo
del desierto,
in front
of a field of pink flowers, Boric said, unscrupulous people are damaging this desert. We need to protect the region and educate people about it. Professor Benito Gómez Silva says there is a lot to learn.
Es trasladar la información que nos entregan nuestros pequeños hermanitos.
It's like translating the information that our little brothers, the microorganisms in the desert, provide for us, he says. Especially with our changing climate, Gómez Silva says these desert plant species could have a lot to teach us humans. For the world, I am Tibi Saicea in the Atacama Desert in Chile.
TV's photos showcase fuchsia, yellow and white blossoms spreading across the pale expanse of the Atacama Desert. We have those pictures for you on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Like father, like son, the legendary Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré, the father, Vieux Farka Touré, the son. Ali is no longer with us. He died in 2006, but Vieux has been carrying on the long tradition of Mali's desert blues. He pays tribute to his dad on the new album simply called Ali. Vieux performs with the Texas psych rock band Krung Bin. Here's a taste. Joining us from the band Krung Bin is Mark Spear, and we also have with us Vieux Farka Touré. This album, Ali, such a beautiful album. These are songs, Vieux, that have deep roots in the land that is the Sahel of West Africa. And the album you made with Krung Bin was recorded in a barn in rural Texas. How much had you traveled in that part of the U.S.? Did you find some similarities with the Sahel in terms of climate and landscape and even feel?
I think that when we talk about Texas, it's as if we're talking about the region around Timbuktu in Mali. We have the same climate, and it really looks like the same place. And while I was there, I found myself feeling like I was back home.
So how did that actually help the music when you got to Texas?
Je pense que c'est ça aussi qui a fait que ça a été très rapide par rapport à l'enregistrement parce que
I think it really helped. When you find yourself feeling at home in that same atmosphere, it gives you a certain way of thinking, of being in your element.
Mark Spear, this album, Ali, it's an homage to Vieux's father, the great, and I don't use that lightly, the great Ali Farka Touré. So tell me how this whole project kind of happened. What was the start?
It was simple as Vieux's team found us, and we met up for some food in London at a London pub. You know, it was like, hey, Vieux Farka Touré wants to do a record with you guys. And I was like, okay, why not?
I mean, the session happened almost as quickly as like the whole kind of solidifying the idea. Describe the barn in Texas where you recorded and the whole vibe and mood that surrounded the recreation of these really powerful songs.
The barn is just a big tin building outside of Burton, Texas. It's got dirt floors, corrugated sides. And you can open up the doors real big and let the wind in and the birds and the bugs and all this kind of stuff. So I don't know. It's just one of those places we like to go because you can be as quiet or as loud as you want. And usually we go quiet.
So Vieux, I understand you made food for everyone during the session. Tell me what you cooked.
Non, c'était du, on appelle ça le zame, comme tu le chebjen, quoi. Le cheb, nous, chez nous, on appelle zame.
I cooked up some chebjen. In Mali, we call it zame. It's red rice with fish.
Richebjen.
Exactly. Because I figured if we're recording a mix that is traditional and modern, then we should eat a little traditional food from Mali to balance that feeling.
And did that work? Did the food energize the music?
Yes, the band loved it.
Mark, what did you think about chebujen rice?
I mean, it was delicious. I wouldn't say it's a heavy meal, but it would definitely make you sleepy, you know?
And once you wake up, then the music cranks, right?
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're back.
I've heard Ali Fakatouré perform this traditional Malian song, Jarabi, this loping, bluesy sound. He performed it famously with Rai Kooter. Vieux, you've played it. And now this fresh take on it between Quang Binh and you, Vieux. I mean, this has got such a deep groove, but it's an important song and has been important for a long time because it has this message about the value of hard work. Is that right?
It's a lot about the value of hard work. Every song we selected for this album is an important song in Mali. Over the years, a lot of things have changed in our country. For example, we have a lot of ethnic groups in Mali, and it used to be the case that you could not marry outside your ethnicity or your social class. Well, this song also talks about the hard work it took to change that, and how Malians see each other today.
Mark Spear, what resonated for you in the song Jarabi, either lyrically or musically?
For me, and like a lot of music that I tend to listen to, it's the melodies that tell the story and what I resonate with. So to me, the melody, I don't know, it wants. It's like welcoming and like kind of yearning. That's kind of what I connected to, which is like the sound of how the notes move around. And it's a beautiful, beautiful song.
Really beautiful stuff. Mark Spear of Quang Binh and Vieux Fakatouré. The new collaboration album is called Ali, an homage to Vieux's father, Ali Fakatouré. Mark, Vieux, thank you very much for being with us. Great to speak.
Thank you. Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
C'est bon?